Loyola Chicago became America's underdog during the NCAA men's basketball tournament. Their run ended Saturday. Still, head coach Porter Moser says what he'll remember is how tight-knit his team was.
Those guys use the word family and love a million times in our locker room, and that's what I'm going to remember is the closeness and how much they invested and bought in.
Plus, they called it the game of change. 55 years ago, the Loyola Ramblers started four black players against an all-white squad that had to defy their governor just to play against an integrated team. Here's Jerry Harkness talking to the Chicago Tribune.
I think the biggest legacy is opening up the game where white ball players in the South especially were going to play against black ball players.
And we'll get the latest in state politics with Chris Kergard from the Peoria Journal-Star and Joe Bustos with the Belleville News-Democrat. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo today. America loves an underdog to root for, and over the past few weeks they got one in the Loyola Chicago Ramblers. The 11th-seeded team was the only one from the state of Illinois to make the tourney, and they themselves hadn't even been to the tournament since 1985. Almost no one had them going very far. In fact, in ESPN's bracket challenge, just 0.48% had them going to the Final Four. But they just kept winning, each time in dramatic fashion. When they made it to the Final Four last week, they had already gone farther than household names like Kentucky, Duke, and North Carolina. On Saturday, that run came to an end with a 69-57 loss to Michigan. Here's Loyola senior Ben Richardson on ESPN after the game.
You can't really feel it yet, but we should be proud because, you know, we did a lot of things that people didn't think we could do, and we played hard and we battled and we gritted a lot of games out, and we made the nation take notice of us.
I'm joined now by WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning.
Let's start with those Ramblers of Loyola Chicago. Before we get to unpacking their run to the Final Four as a whole, let's talk about the game on Saturday. What made the difference in their loss against Michigan?
The turnovers. They had too many turnovers, especially in that second half when they did have a 10-point lead. And also Mo Wagner, the Wolverines center/forward, who had a monster game. So they couldn't overcome those. And it maybe could because of the moment. Maybe it's because, you know, they had really put a lot of effort into and they were unable to shoot the high percentage shots that they normally would get down, which is very difficult to do in dome stadiums these days.
Yeah, I think it looked like both teams maybe had an issue with that shooting in the dome, especially in the first half of the game.
Yeah, that's always going to be a problem. Villanova South, you know, they're a remarkable team, but it's very difficult. And sometimes when you don't shoot well, it can rattle your confidence just a little bit, so you're not as comfortable as you usually are. But Michigan made the adjustments, and Michigan really forced the hand as far as turning the ball over, and they capitalized on it. So the Ramblers had an opportunity, but you could really feel the momentum really shifted once Michigan was chipping away at that lead, and of course they dominated the rest of the game.
Yeah, talking about shooting in those domed stadiums, just the much larger arena, I think, sometimes interferes with players' depth perception there. But it looked like after the game, you could really see how disappointed the players were. I think they and their fans and Sister Jean really thought they could win the whole thing.
Well, you know what? I was around this team the last few weeks, and they really felt good about themselves. They're very well coached. Porter Moser really deserves a lot of credit for the way he prepares this team. They never felt that they were underdogs, you know, and so that's probably half the battle in order to be confident to be able to go into these games. They have a chemistry. You talk about a team that has seven players that had high school championships when, you know, to be on this team. So you have players that have been in good challenges as far as high school experience. It is a different stage once you get to the Final Four because you go to a practice. They had open practice on Friday. They had 30,000 people there. Mm-hmm. They had a practice. You know, Loyola plays at a gymnasium. It's called Joe Gentile Arena, where they seat 4,900 people. You know, so there's big differences once you hit that stage, which is also a court that's on a raised court where your bench is down below. And, you know, I don't like the whole thing about playing in football stadiums, as you can tell. But the stage was much brighter, much more intense. But they did everything well to get where they got.
I'm wondering if you can place this Final Four run in a bit of context for us. First, I guess just in the context of Chicago sports, the Bulls aren't having a very good season. The Blackhawks are going to miss the playoffs. And besides Loyola, you know, 55 years ago, no men's team in Illinois has ever even won a national college basketball title. What did this run mean to the city?
It meant a lot. It meant a lot to the Loyola, you know, campus, Loyola University. And it really galvanized the city because, you know, both baseball teams are starting on the road. And you're right. This is the first time in 10 years we're not going to see playoffs at the United Center. So it's very unusual situation. And so it was prime time. Before the Bulls were popular, before Michael Jordan hit the scene, DePaul basketball was the game in Chicago. And they really, you know, it was really huge, the DePaul men's basketball team. And so there's been a lot of, you know, unfortunate situations where the teams here in Chicago has not played well. Now, Illinois went to the championship game in 05, so you could look at them. But as far as Chicago goes, there's not been a lot to cheer about. Yes, Loyola went to the Sweet 16 in 85, but there's been such a drought here for Chicago college basketball teams that Loyola was a big deal. And Northwestern last year, I have to, you know, them making the tournament for the first time was a great story, but they didn't go far into the tournament, where Loyola now has captured all the attention, and rightfully so, because what Porter Moser does, if they could keep him, that's going to be key, they could really have a strong program going forward beyond just this year.
For people listening who might not follow college basketball, can you kind of explain where Loyola sat in the pecking order of college basketball and what it means for schools like them that, you know, they got farther in the tournament than some of the blue bloods like Kentucky and North Carolina?
Well, you know, you have to understand that Loyola plays for a mid-major conference. They're in the Missouri Valley Conference, which they only joined a couple years ago. They used to be in the Horizon, which was even lesser considered conference. So Loyola's in a mid-major. In fact, they had to win their tournament, even though they had a terrific record. If they didn't win their tournament for Missouri Valley Conference, they would not have gotten the automatic bid to even get into the, you know, the NCAA tournament. So they got seeded number 11th. And, you know, when you really look back now, you go, boy, that was really a low seed for them to be 11th. But the problem is you have five power conferences, and those conferences, in like Big Ten, ACC, you know, those conferences are always going to get the glamour. They're always going to get the higher seeds. They're always going to get the at-large bids. And that's why it's very hard, very, very hard, for the conferences that are considered lesser, and I use that in quotes because I don't believe that's true, than like Missouri Valley Conference. And that's unfortunate because a lot of those conferences, because they don't get the one-and-dones, the players are going to go to the NBA after the freshman year, they really build really solid programs. You know, when you look at Loyola, you build your program with players that are, you know, they don't have aspirations for the NBA. So they're going to go to school. They're going to be at your college for 4 years. So you have the time to develop them and to develop your program. Unfortunately, when you look at the college landscape, most colleges will only give their coaches 2 years, maybe 3 years, to really turn things around. Porter Moser was allowed to do this for 7 years. He had failures at Illinois State, and he got fired from there, even though he took him to the NCAA tournament. And so it's interesting now, the way it is right now, the way college basketball is right now, if you're not at one of the top programs, you're really not looked at well when it comes to the NCAA tournament.
Of course, we've got the final tonight with a couple of teams that have been pretty good in college basketball here the last several years, Michigan and Villanova. What are you expecting to see in tonight's championship game?
Well, Villanova, if they could shoot the way they're an anomaly as far as the way they shot the other night with all the three-pointers that they could score. And of course, they're led by, you know, Stevenson High School's Jalen Brunson, who was the player of the year. It should be their game at hand. But if Michigan could play defense like they can make this a game. But I really think Villanova has the upper hand on this game.
My guest is WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. If you have any thing you'd like to add on our conversation of the NCAA men's basketball tournament here and Loyola's run, you can give us a call at 800 888-222-9455, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. I'm talking with Cheryl Ray Stout here this morning. And Cheryl, there was not an Illinois team in the women's tournament that made a big run, but I have to ask you about how the last few days have gone, because it was probably more dramatic than the men's games have been. Last night, Notre Dame won the national title over Mississippi State on a game-winning shot at the buzzer. How dramatic was the end of that game?
It's two games in a row. You know, they beat UConn the same way. That was a great last-second shot. In fact, and I want to get her name right, Eureka Ogunbowale. She's the one that hit the shot against Connecticut for, you know, to get into the national championship, and she got the ball. And she wasn't even the player that was supposed to get the ball. The inbound pass was supposed to go inside. It was a makeup decision by the inbounder to throw it to her. She hits that shot. It was incredible, because you're talking about a team in Notre Dame, and you know, it's been 17 years since they won a national championship, and Muffet, she really had difficulties with injuries all year long, and to win this title, that was huge. It was exciting.
Yeah, it really was. Muffet McGraw, of course, the head coach of Notre Dame. But and you mentioned that they knocked off UConn in much the same way on Friday. You know, UConn has, here the last 2 years, they've gone into the tournament unbeaten, and here they've gotten beaten in the semifinals. That was a heck of a game on Friday night as well.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes people, the question mark is, and it's hard to question UConn and what they've done, but they beat teams so dramatically all season long. They have big wins, and yet when they came down to some of these tight games, which is what they did last year and this year, they didn't win the game. And so they're not a failure by any means because of all the titles that they have, but you wonder right now if it's just now a psychological disadvantage for them to not have tight games going into the tournament. That may be a factor for this club.
Cheryl, I'd like to pull back for just a moment here and talk a little bit about the NCAA as a whole. Of course, March Madness is their largest event of the year, but behind all that, it's been kind of a tumultuous basketball season. The FBI has been investigating coaches, agents, and apparel companies. Some people have gotten fired, and some have even gotten arrested. There have obviously been some incredible moments on the court during the past few weeks, but is college sports as a whole in a good place right now?
It's interesting when you think about that, because I think the NCAA was so happy to have Loyola and Sister Jean to kind of gloss over the issue that probably would have been talked about a lot, and that's the scandal that's going on. They have to this, you know, this is not the first time. This comes up every few years, but this one seems to be a little more of a bigger grip on the NCAA and especially these programs where there's so much money, you know, changing hands. And, you know, the joke was about the NCAA tournament, how many teams are going to have to vacate their wins, because there's so many. You know, Yahoo did a great job and ESPN did a great job of revealing. You know, you're talking about Duke, North Carolina, Texas, Kentucky, Michigan State, USC, Kansas. I could, you know, on and on and on, all these schools that are under this investigation. This is a problem, and if they don't clean it up, it's going to have long-term effects. And all the families are going to be affected by this, and all these players. And you know what's going to happen is there are going to be a lot of coaches that are going to, you know, eventually these coaches are going to get fired. And then you're going to see what the movement's going to be. How do they look at their programs going forward? Do they look for some coaches that they think are going to be clean? I don't think it's possible.
And Cheryl, just to kind of maybe explain this scandal a little bit more to those who haven't been following, it has to do with money being handed under the table to players. Is that right?
Right, money to the players, their families, and it's done usually via the shoe companies. So it's agents being involved, it is some high school coaches being involved, it's the parents being involved, it is usually the assistant coaches being involved, and sometimes the head coaches are involved. It could be, as you know, like $10,000 up to $100,000, but it's money to get players to come to their schools, or money for the assistants to direct the player that's going to go into the NBA to take a certain shoe contract. So it's a dirty business.
Yeah.
And it's not like this is the first time it's happening. It's just it's now peeling back many more programs involved.
I guess for you at this point, Cheryl, what are some of the biggest questions that lie ahead here in the next couple of years for the NCAA?
Well, first off, they got to come clean, and they have to be transparent about it. They can't, you know, they can't brush this aside anymore. And you know, there's a lot of talk about possibly paying players, and I'm not talking about exorbitant fees, but maybe a stipend, because right now the way the rules are in the NCAA, they can't even, you know, they're not supposed to accept a dime from anything, and maybe just give them a stipend so that they could be on campus. So you're talking about a lot of these young men. And, you know, women that are where they come from, they don't have the means to live on a campus the way other kids can. If you're from the inner city where, you're an at-risk kid, and yes, you could play basketball, and yes, you could play football, and you could play on the college level, but you can't even go get pizza because you don't have the money. And I know people go, well, they're getting a college education. But most of the kids that are going to college, they do have some funds to help them along. A lot of these kids do not. That's why they are accepting this money.
And, of course, this is all happening while, you know, TV contracts are generating huge amounts of money for the school, in large part because of the contributions the players make. And coaches are making multimillion dollar salaries as well. So I think, you know, players are only wondering, hey, where's my share?
Absolutely. They see that, you know, the coaches, you got an example of John Calipari, you know, at Kentucky. He makes $8 million a year. That's just a salary. We don't even know how much money he's making from other contracts that he has. And the players are, and the players' likenesses are used, but they're not getting anything for it. They're living, they're getting the millions and millions of dollars that are made by the universities and millions of dollars being made by the networks. That's coming off the players. So it's something's got to give, and eventually it's got to be addressed, because you can't have this disparity between what the colleges are making, what the coaches are making, what the networks are making, and the kids, it's coming off their backs.
Cheryl Ray Stout is a contributor to WBEZ. Cheryl, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting A Return to the Madhouse, Climate Change Denial in the Age of Trump, April 6th at 3 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. Professor Michael Mann will examine the evidence of climate change and the reasons we should care. cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about basketball on today's show, as many of us had our eyes glued to games this weekend following our favorite March Madness teams. For many in Illinois, that team was Loyola of Chicago. Looking at who's on the court in college basketball, more than half of men's Division I players are African American, and so are nearly three-quarters of NBA players. But in 1963, the Ramblers of Loyola Chicago started four black players, at a time when most coaches were afraid to start more than one or two. And when they were scheduled to play against an all-white team in Mississippi State, their opponents had to defy their own governor just to step onto the court. Joining me now is Rich Rochelle, a member of that 1963 Loyola championship team. And Tony Giannetti is also with us. She's a longtime sports writer for the Chicago Sun-Times. Rich and Tony, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Nice to be
Thank
with you,
you very
Brian.
Much.
Tony, let's start with you. I'd like for you to set the scene for us here. It's 1963, and Loyola Chicago has four black players in its starting lineup. How common was that in college basketball at that time?
Well, it was very rare. I've often said in the years that I've covered basketball, and I wasn't, you know, around at the time, but growing up and studying the sport, you realize that Chicago was kind of unique and had two very special coaches in George Ireland at Loyola and Ray Meyer at DePaul. And they were great rivals. And I think Rich would probably, you know, recognize that. But they also were very, you know, now we think of it as forward thinking. They recruited players. They not by the color of their skin, but by their ability and what they could coach. And I think that. So while it was still difficult in Chicago, because Chicago, even at the time, was a very segregated kind of city. I think the players at Loyola and probably at DePaul, but especially at Loyola because they were so highly ranked in 1963, they went through their own trials and tribulations even in their home city.
Yeah, and I think we'll get into some of those with Rich here in mm-hmm. just a moment. But
mm-hmm. right.
But Rich, you were, of course, one of the players on that 1963 team. I'm curious, what brought you to Loyola Chicago originally?
Well, I was, you know, I lived in Skokie, Evanston area. And Ireland recruited me very strongly for Loyola. At the time, he didn't realize that he was going to get so many talented players from Tennessee and New York. So he recruited me rather heavily to come down to Loyola.
And at that time, I understand that, you know, most college coaches weren't willing to place more than maybe one or two African-American players on a team at a time. But, Rich, for the Ramblers, your coach started four black players. At the time, did that surprise you, or did it really not come up just because you were so focused on playing the game?
We were focused on playing the game. Now, we realized that there was an unspoken rule that you could only play two black players at a time. And if you were losing badly, you could put the third one on the floor. Ireland's decision was based on the fact that he was in trouble at Loyola, to be quite honest. The students had hung him in effigy the year before. Mm. He had not a good record. And he just got very, very lucky when he got Jerry Harkness, Ron Miller, and the two guys, Vic Rouse and Hunter, from Pearl High School in Tennessee. And he didn't realize what he had until it was there.
Mm. Tony, let's bring you back in here. Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
An accident of riches, you might say.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, the Ramblers made it to the semifinal game in the tournament, and their opponent is Mississippi State. But there's a big mm-hmm. problem there. It's not clear whether the game would actually happen. Tell us a little bit about why that was.
Well,
go ahead, Tony.
Okay. Hi, Rich. Yes. the situation involved Mississippi State had been a very strong team for several years. But the unwritten rule in Mississippi was you could not play against integrated teams. So that for the two prior years, the Mississippi State had to forfeit their right to go to the tournament because basically their government, the state government, wouldn't allow them to play against integrated teams. That was the year that the University of Mississippi accepted its first black player, only because federal troops had to go in and protect him as he enrolled. And that was in the fall of 1962. So now that's the 62-63 season. And, you know, maybe 100 miles away, Mississippi State is still an all-white school, but their university president is watching all this going on, and he doesn't want to see the same kind of things happen on his campus. And he tells his coach and his athletic director, if you win this year, we're going to find a way to get you to the tournament. So they win their conference, and they're scheduled to go to the NCAA tournament. But, again, they're supposed to – they know they're going to be end up playing Loyola. And the regional was set in Michigan State, in Lansing, Michigan. So the NCAA, Loyola, nobody even knows if Mississippi State is going to make it because the state government orders, you know, the governor, Ross Barnett, goes to court and they get an injunction to bar the team from leaving the state. It's pretty dramatic story. Mm-hmm. They end up having to, you know, and they're worried about protests on campus and the basketball players just want to play basketball. So they're hiding out. The coach of the team leaves the state and goes to Georgia, Atlanta, and waits mm-hmm. and waits there. So that what they're doing is they all their officials kind of went to different places so they couldn't be served the injunction.
Yeah.
The trainer of the team, they tell the kids, wait in your dorm. The trainer of the team takes a group of the second string players on a bus heading to the airport at night to see if they get stopped. They don't. The local sheriff decides, he kind of looks the other way, and there's another kind of so-called hero in the story. He's not going to serve the injunction. He waits. The team...
He went
so
to lunch,
the team
or he went to dinner.
Right. Right, well, I think, but he knew, I think they all kind of knew, and he waited. So that the team...
Cheek.
Yep. Then the team comes under cover of night. There was one story that the assistant coach, they're in a car headed to the airport, and they see a sheriff's car nearby, and he gets down on the floor of the car so that he's not seen, just in case somebody's going to serve him with the injunction. The team makes it to the airport. They leave. And they all meet up then up in East Lansing. And again, I don't even know that they had a lot of warm-up time or anything. I know that the story goes that they had obviously no band, no cheerleaders, no nothing. And when they arrive, the one of the bands there, I don't even know if it was the Loyola Band or one of the other ones, plays the team's fight song, you know, to kind of welcome them. They play the game. You know, it was pretty historic. There's a plaque that they put up at the University of at Michigan State, the site of the game, commemorating that game of change.
Yeah, absolutely. Rich, let's bring you back in here. What do you remember from that time right before the game? Was there a period of time where you weren't sure whether Mississippi State was going to show up?
We didn't know whether they were going to show up, and when they did show up, they were so well received. The Michigan people, the people from the state itself, welcomed them and became their cheering section because they didn't have one of their own. But we questioned whether or not there would be a game. One of the other things you have to understand is that a lot of things were going on that we were not aware of. It was kind of, you know, we were a bunch of young guys participating in an NCAA tournament, and that was our primary focus. But as the word leaked out to us about what these guys had gone through just to be able to make it there, and prepare for that game, we were kind of astonished because we thought this type of thing can only happen to us. It shouldn't happen, you know, to a state-supported school with young men who are trying to do exactly what we're doing, just win a championship.
Yeah, and Rich, I also understand that some people weren't happy that an integrated team like yours was playing against Mississippi State. What kind of issues did your team face? Was there hate mail, anything else like that going on?
Oh, definitely. And Mr. Ireland kept as much of it away from us as he could. But we were getting threatening letters from the Ku Klux Klan, the White Knights, and et cetera. And I felt very sorry for Jerry because Jerry Harkness, being the All-American, being the leader of the team, received the brunt of this type of mail. But Ireland tried to keep it from us as much as possible. And it got personal. It got to a point where the mail let us know, you know, such things as they knew where we lived, they knew where our families were, that type of thing. So it was a scary situation.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, it's a lot for for kids that are, you know, between 18 and 22 years old to go through. How did you handle it?
We banded together, and you need to understand too that the students at Loyola supported us and banded with us. We were an enigma. Our team was an enigma. Again, you know, the rules said you can start to so on and so forth. And when they found out that we were receiving this type of treatment, these letters were coming that we were, you know, always going places in pairs or threes or fours for our own protection. The students on campus also banded with us and made sure that we felt comfortable with the situation.
Tony, back to you. Of course, Loyola wins that game 61-51, and as you referenced, it's often called the game of change. How did it come to be known as the game of change?
You know, I think because it broke a barrier, obviously. You had an all-white team from the South defied its state and played and integrated a team of four black starters, you know, and that it was another barrier coming down in the civil rights movement. And I think we often hear about, and the movie was made about a couple years later when the five black starters that won a national championship from
Texas Western.
Texas Western, which became, I think, UTEP.
Right.
And all the publicity was put on that team. But the ground was really broken by the 63 Loyola team and what they did. And I think it wasn't all that known until the 50th anniversary was coming up in 2013. And I think it was Jerry Harkness's son who put together a documentary talking about it and commemorating it, and the NCAA recognized it and made it one of their one of the top moments in NCAA history, dedicated the plaque at the site of the game to mark it forever. And I think Rich knows the White House, President Obama invited the 63 team to come to the White House in 2013 to mark the 50th year since that game of change and their championship.
Yeah, and Rich, of course, we mentioned this game against Mississippi State wasn't even the title game. Of course, your Ramblers went on to win the national championship against Cincinnati in a thrilling game. What do you remember about that title game?
Oh, the title game? Well, we were expected to lose it. Cincinnati had already won two championships. They were expected to win it big. People kind of, like they did this year with the Loyola team, they did not have a lot of confidence in us as a team being able to go up against Goliath. It was a David versus Goliath situation. And we always felt that, okay, keep looking down your nose at us and not giving us the credit for the type of work that we were putting in to, you know, prepare for this meeting. And it was a long, you know, all year long, it was the most anticipated game. People wanted to see this game take place. And it was a game where we started off very, very slow. We were nervous. We had not been there before. Cincinnati came out, and they were one heck of a team. You have to start with that fact. You had guys like George Wilson, Tom Thacker.
Rich, I'm so sorry. We're going to have to cut it off right there. We're out of time. But Rich Rochelle from the 1963 Loyola team, Tony Giannetti from the Chicago Sun-Times, thanks so much for joining us to talk about the game of change.
real pleasure.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual Book, Jacket, and Journal Show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, April 2nd through the 13th. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. It's another election year in Illinois and across the nation. Sometimes that can make it difficult to get things done in the state house, especially this year when the Democrats in the majority are hoping that their candidate, J.B. Pritzker, unseats the current Republican governor, Bruce Rauner. The primaries were 2 weeks ago. Now it's just a seven-month marathon until the November election. Meanwhile, the legislature is in recess and will be back in session next week. Joining me now, Chris Kergard, political reporter with the Peoria Journal-Star, and Joe Bustos, reporter with the Belleville News-Democrat. Joe and Chris, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, let's start with you. We'll begin with where the General Assembly is right now. They're in recess. They'll be back on Monday. Do we know yet what issues they might take up over the next 7 weeks of the legislative session?
Well, of course, the big one is going to be the budget, on which they usually don't get down to real business until the mid part of May. And given the last several years of budget fights down there, I expect another contentious disagreement on that. Otherwise, I would expect it'll be a lot of nibbling around the edges on things. The sexual harassment issues that came out earlier in the year with regard to Speaker Madigan and his organization have kind of frozen things over down there a little bit. Everybody's looking at their policies there, as well as kind of waiting for the investigation that the Speaker commissioned with three relatively high-ranking women in the Democratic Party to take a look at his organization and policies that they need to institute or changes that they need to make. On top of that, I would expect a number of other smaller issues and parochial issues relevant to local districts to play a factor in the next couple of weeks, because, of course, every legislator wants to go into a reelection season being able to say, I passed X for our local area. One big thing to watch, I think, would be whether or not a bipartisan push to change the redistricting language in the Constitution gets any traction. It's been introduced by a Republican in the House, where, of course, it's been a problem getting it passed before, and it's been introduced by several reform Democrats in the Senate, where there's a better likelihood that it might end up getting called for a vote. But right now, that constitutional amendment is sitting in committees in both chambers, waiting to actually be assigned and to have hearings.
Chris, also wondering if the legislature might take up the bill that Governor Rauner recently vetoed that would have required gun dealers to get licenses from the state. Do you think there'll be a push for an override there?
I think absolutely there's going to be a pushed override on that, and that's also a function of political strategy going into the general election for Democrats and Republicans alike, and both sides wanting to make sure that they're able to both satisfy their base and have a cudgel to beat the opponent with in the election.
Joe, over to you. What do you think is going to happen here in Springfield? Do you think there will be any productive legislation that comes through the state house in the next several weeks?
I think one of the things I'm waiting to see, a very local issue for us, is any kind of like gambling expansion or that might be discussed. We have a local racetrack that has Fairmont Park, it's only scheduled 41 racing days this year, and they've said if there isn't any kind of new revenue source approved, i.e. casino-style gambling or video gaming allowed at racetracks, they may have to cut down their dates for this year. They were looking at having a meeting with their staff in mid-May about whether to cut down their dates to, I think, 19 dates for the season, and that's something. There are a couple bills out there. There's a state Senate bill that's been passed, but sitting in the House that allows for a large gambling expansion, which allows for a Chicago casino, and there's a smaller quote-unquote Band-Aid that's been proposed by some local legislators in the Metro East that will allow 150 video gaming stations at racetracks. So that's, I think, one thing that we're keeping an eye out for.
What does that track mean to your area? How big of an employer is it?
I mean, they will help employ the people who grow the hay for the horses, the veterinarians, there's lots of carpenters who will do work around the track. So it's sometimes upwards of like 300 to 400 people at the track at any one time. There's who have to take tickets. There are people who have to who will serve drinks and food. So it's obviously a big economic engine for the area, especially if they could get back on some stronger footing.
Chris, has the State House spent much time in session this year relative to previous years?
The second year of a session going into an election year is usually a more abbreviated session, and we see that in their schedules. Each chamber only spent 4 days in March in session, and of course we had the primary, which many of them had to be out campaigning and knocking on doors, even though few of them were contested. They all want to run up their numbers in a primary and going into the general election in the fall. We've got the House, which by the time they return will not have been in session for a solid month. But really where the rubber meets the road every year is in April and May. And much like last year and in previous years, they've got a fairly aggressive schedule of 4 day weeks and even some 5 day weeks that they're planning in Springfield, which for legislators to be on the floor rather than dealing with constituent issues back home, it is a fairly heavy workload. And for those people who have been down for rallies or other advocacy on session days, they're familiar with those days beginning very early in the morning and lasting well into the afternoon and evening and moving very fast through issues.
Joe, the governor gave his budget address back in February, and the state has until the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, to pass a budget. We certainly know the state hasn't been very good at meeting those deadlines in recent years. Are you seeing trouble ahead when it comes to the State House and the governor agreeing on a budget here in the next couple of months?
You've got a governor who's got a low approval rating, and you've got Democrats who have been calling for progressive income taxes. So we had a 2-year budget impasse. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's additional trouble when it comes to getting something passed. But then again, there's also trying to come up with something in this election year to show that that the legislature and the governor are trying to get something done. But again, it's going to come down to the politics of it and whether both sides can see it a political advantage to getting anything coming to some sort of compromise on a budget.
Chris, you touched on this a little while ago, but the issue of sexual harassment certainly looms over much of state government. You may have heard, listeners may have heard about Elena Hampton, who was sexually harassed for months by Chicago Alderman Marty Quinn's brother, Kevin. This all happened while she was working for House Speaker Michael Madigan's political operation in Chicago. Chris, what's happening next in this story?
Well, she has a federal lawsuit that's been filed claiming essentially retaliation against her, that she didn't get any contracts to work for Democrats after she began making these reports. But she's now gone farther on this, and in addition to that federal lawsuit, is asking the City Hall Inspector General and the Ethics Board overseeing City Hall to investigate whether or not Marty Quinn, the Chicago alderman, improperly acted or improperly failed to report the material that she brought to him. Now, and that certainly makes a headline. What's a little difficult about it is historically the ethics watchdogs who oversee the Chicago City Council have not been regarded as having a lot of authority to go after or deliver more than a slap on the wrist to anybody that they investigate. They've been called toothless by any number of organizations. And even though there have been some slight changes there over the last year or so, it's really a question of whether or not somebody in an ethics watchdog position overseeing the city council is going to be able to, A, find a violation, because though she's asked for that investigation, she has not cited what she believes to have been the specific violation when asked by reporters about it. But two, if they do find something, whether or not an inspector general there can manage to levy any penalties against somebody who's fairly well politically connected. It's a challenge in Chicago.
Oh, of course. And I guess, you know, what could the real consequences here be for both Kevin Quinn, who was accused of the harassment, and his brother Marty? Any real consequences possible here?
Well, the biggest consequence at this point is in the court of public opinion. By keeping this story going, it helps keep alive the questions about what else may or may not have happened in Speaker Madigan's organization, in the organizations of people associated with him. And it also raises questions about other powerful Democrats around the state and powerful Republicans around the state on whether any complaints came to them. We've only seen these reports about those associated with Madigan. We've not really heard or had any numbers detailed on complaints that have been brought relative to Senate Democrats or Senate Republicans or House Republicans. And there are still a lot of open questions out there. But at this point, the person that this is really bad for is Marty Quinn, Kevin Quinn, and Speaker Madigan, for this story to be continuing and to get a whole new element to it.
Joe, as we said earlier, we certainly don't know what's going to happen in the State House over the coming weeks. But in the meantime, you've been reporting on the Metro East area and Southern Illinois for the Belleville News Democrat. Mm-hmm. What are some of the biggest stories and issues coming out of your area here over this past week?
I think one of the biggest pieces of news is State Senator Kyle McCarter being nominated by President Trump to be the next ambassador to Kenya. Senator McCarter has done a lot of missionary work in Kenya for over the last 30 years. He's helped build a clinic there that serves like 15,000 people a year. He applied for this job about a year ago, went through the interview process, and finally heard back last week that he was going to be nominated. One thing that's interesting about this particular nomination is Kyle McCarter isn't running for re-election. He said he wasn't going to run for re-election, and he was, quote-unquote, looking for his next assignment. He, in 2016, he actually challenged Congressman John Shimkus from the right as a Tea Party-backed candidate. He was endorsed by the Club for Growth, and he lost in the primary. And then last year, after he applied for this ambassadorship, he ended up being recommended for it by every single Republican member of the Illinois congressional delegation, including Congressman Shimkus, who congratulated Senator McCarter on being nominated. What's interesting is if McCarter did say in the past, if he did not get this ambassador position, he would consider running again for Congress. And he ultimately gets this, and a potential challenger to John Shimkus is probably, if he's confirmed by the Senate, will be going overseas doing some, which we hope is good work over there.
McCarter's Senate seat, one, is it competitive, and two, who's running for it?
So there were only there were four Republicans who ran for the nomination. There weren't any Democrats in the race, and the Republican who won was Jason Plummer, who ran for lieutenant governor in 2010, and then he ran for lieutenant governor in 2010 and lost, and then he ran for Congress in 2012 against Bill Enyart and then lost. So Jason Plummer won the primary in the four-person race, and as long as Democrats don't field a candidate for that seat, where probably Jason Plummer is looking like he's going to Springfield.
All right. I think that's about all the time we have for today, but always good to catch up with Chris Kjærgaard from the Peoria Journal-Star, Joe Bustos from the Belleville News Democrat. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there. Just say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us, or if you would like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecelio. Fatima Farha is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.